Blog Talk Radio. Hi, good evening. Welcome to Witch Talk Radio, Ohio Valley. I'm your host, Kristen Lee. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in tonight. Hi, Daniel. Daniel's with us, too.
Hello, how's it going?
He is the mastermind behind all of the techie parts that I can't do.
You could call it that.
Yeah, I opened up a Twitter page today.
You did what?
Yeah.
A Twitter?
Yeah.
You?
I owe you $200.
You owe me, like, $5.
I said I'd never do it, and you said, I bet you $200 you will one day. Remember that?
Man, I knew I should have made it more. But that's okay. I'll take it.
Yeah, well, you have to wait for it.
Well, if you just buy me a Starbucks every day, we'll call it even.
Oh, speaking of Starbucks, you know, my friend Jill totally pranked me today. She sent me a tag from her husband on social media that Dunkin' Donuts filed bankruptcy. And I seriously almost had a heart attack. Yeah.
That they filed bankruptcy?
Yeah, and they were closing in November. Yeah. I lost it. I look like a cartoon character because my eyes almost bulged out of my head, right?
I could imagine.
Yeah. Okay. Well, without further ado, we have a very special guest tonight. Andrea Perrone is, she's been a good friend of mine for quite some time. We met probably, gosh, she's going to have to help me out with this, 4 or 5 years ago in Waverly, Ohio. I think it was Waverly, Ohio. But without further ado, I would like to bring Andrea on, and here we go. Hello, dear. Are you with us?
I am. I'm here. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and coming in tonight to talk to us. It's so such a pleasure to have you. Such a pleasure.
Oh, it's great. Yes, we did actually meet in Waverly, Ohio. It was during the when we had the event at the Emmett House, which so sadly burned down to the ground about 2 years after the event. And it was never determined how that happened or who started it or what. It was a terrible loss, a really historically significant building that was right on what was the original Erie Canal, and it's gone. So we have our memories, and I have lots and lots of great photographs of the place, but that was a shame. But still, I met you there, and we had a wonderful instantaneous connection that I have cherished ever since. You've been on my friends list now for years, and we just, every now and then, we connect and then reconnect, and months might go by before we talk, but when we do, it's always so precious to me.
Oh, yes, it is. Thank you so much. I do enjoy our conversations. They are simply the best, you know? So I contacted you, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, something like that, to see if you could come onto the show. And I noticed yesterday and the day before over the weekend, you did Para-Disney. What was that like?
Oh, I did Para-Disney. Yes, it was great. I'm actually, right now, I'm with George at his home in Palm Coast. And
Hi, George.
We went together to the Para-Disney event in Orlando. Which Dana Wingard sponsored and was a wonderful host, and we had a great time. And George gave me the grand tour of Epcot, which I had never been to. And I was mesmerized, completely overwhelmed by what a beautiful experience it was. He's been there numerous times. I had, as I said, not been there yet. So he knew the ins and outs of places to take me, what to show me, he knew I'd be fascinated with. And we had a wonderful time. We had a blast. And then he dropped me back off at my house in Winter Garden and then came back to Palm Coast. And I came in today. Not very many people know this yet, but the reason I'm here is to do the final read-through before submission of our first literary work together. We've written a novel together. It's his idea. He gets all the credit conceptually. It is the most incredible story I've ever read, and that's coming from someone who has read thousands of books in her life. And I've never read a story like this. And about 18 months ago, George during one of our, I believe one of our late night chats, told me this story that had been kicking around in his head for approximately a quarter of a century that he had spent developing the characters, working on the plot line. And I guess in his spare thinking time, I'm not sure, he just originated this incredible story unlike anything that I have ever read in my lifetime. And he told me the story, and my five words to him when it was over, when I was done wiping the tears off my eyes, I said, you have to write this down. And he said, I'm not a writer. And I said, yeah, I am. And if you would just write it down, I'll help you turn it into, like, the best novel of the great American novel. And he laughed. And I said, no, I'm serious. And so it began 18 months ago. And we are doing our final read-through. And the moment we're done, it goes off to be published. And I'm very excited to be here and to be a part of this. So that's what I've been doing all day, is you've been messaging me back and forth, and large gaps of time will go before I answer. It's because we're delving into another chapter.
Sure.
But I'm so thrilled. I've been kind of off the grid. Everybody in my tribe will tell you that I have been off the grid now for several months, for the most part, because we were into the very thick of it. And now is the time. The time has arrived to birth this baby and get her out into the world. And I'm thrilled. I'm delighted. I'm as delighted about this as I was to finish the trilogy. So that tells you what kind of significance it has.
Wow. Yes. Yes. Are you able to share the title of the new publication that's coming out?
I can share the title with you, but that's about it.
Good.
I'll give you just a little background, a little bit.
Okay.
The title is In a Flicker. And I can tell you that because we already copyrighted the thing. So did the copyright on it a while ago. So, yes, its title is In a Flicker. And I will tell you that it is a fascinating, intricate, disturbing amalgamation of fact and fiction. And what is most disturbing about it is the factual essence of the story. It is set in, part of it is set in England, and it is, gosh, I'm trying to choose my words very carefully here.
Sure, take your time. Take your time.
I said, you better. say that again. Say that again. What was your question, then?
Oh, I said, take your time. Take your time to choose your words wisely, because I know George is right beside you.
Yeah, especially because George is right beside me, yes. It is, this will be, well, let me tell you this. Okay. Two people who are very close to us, who are professional writers and editors themselves, have both read this book. So there have been four sets of eyes keenly honed in on this manuscript. And the two women who have read it have gone through it with a fine-tooth comb with us, have said that they will never forget the characters, that it has become a part of their consciousness, that they will be haunted for the rest of their lives by what they just read, and they're as excited as we are to see it go out into the world, because it is the kind of literature that is essentially interactive. It draws you into the book, and you literally become an emotional part of it. And it will never leave you, and it will expand your consciousness in ways that are absolutely inexplicable.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. We're like, wow, we want to read this book.
Can I read it right now?
It's really tough. My readers of the trilogy are going to be absolutely shocked that my name is on the cover of this book next to George. They will be shocked. And in fact, there are a few who I know well enough to tell them that they might not want to read it because I know how sensitive they are and how emotionally engrossed they get. And as soon as I've said that to each one of them, they're like, oh, well, that's it, then I have to. You know, maybe that should be my promotional point. Don't read this book.
Right, look, but don't touch. Look, but don't
you
read.
You probably can't handle this book. As soon as I say that, they're like, I want the first signed copy. Oh, God, people are great.
So what's the big day?
My readers are fabulous, and we're just going to bring them on along. I will tell you one more thing, Kristen.
Okay.
It does have a little tiny bit of a supernatural twist to it, but it's minor. For the most part, it's a mystery for the most part, and it's a psychological thriller. This will not be in the paranormal section of a bookstore. I'm not sure what headings we'll put it under, but and I'll let you know when we do how people
okay.
can find it quickly. But this is, I don't know if there is a heading in a bookstore that could appropriately receive a work like this. It covers the gamut of, it's an emotional roller coaster ride, and it covers the gamut. There's like no subject it doesn't touch on. Yes, George. George would like to say something. Hold on.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Call in, George.
Hi, how are you?
We'll get you both on.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here, too. Yeah, I when we were at the Paranormal Disney World event this weekend, some people were asking about this, and I kind of figured out how to wrap it all up together, what this story is about. It is about the worst fear that you have in yourself. It's the worst fear that you have in your mate. It's the worst fear that your mate has in himself and the worst fear that your mate has in you.
Wow. Oh, nice.
Wow, I've got chills. Chills upon chills. Oh, my gosh. This is going to be awesome. So
yeah,
when can we get it?
When can you get it?
Yes.
I'll tell you what, the instant this book goes live on the market, I will flood the internet with the news. There's no way you'll not see that In a Flicker has been published. And I will, very proudly introduce it. And in fact, George and I intend, if we can get it fast enough, and my publisher is all over this, they know there's a time limit on this because we would like to premiere it over Halloween weekend when we go to the Undead Con. And we're going to be lecturing with Anne Rice in New Orleans at the Undead Con. And
yes,
I think because of the nature of this story, it could not have a more perfect fit.
That's awesome. That is such good news. Well, congratulations, you and George. And hey, if George wants to call in and talk a little, he's more than welcome to call in too. That's completely up to the both of you.
He doesn't even need to call in. I've got it on speakerphone. All he needs to do is bring me my coffee, and when he's done, you may speak to him whenever you want. But right now, he's waiting on me hand and foot. And I know that that's not going to last more than about another 15 minutes. And then, the party's over and I'm on my own. I get that. But for right now, he's getting me a cup of coffee, which is incredibly endearing. And I appreciate it deeply. So when he returns, I'll just put the phone between us and he can hear everything that you say and can answer at will.
Sure. Absolutely. Awesome. Very good. So, we have a lot of listeners listening to you tonight because you're very, very famous for your works of House of Darkness, House of Light. And Andrea, even today, a lot of people here, a lot of the locals didn't realize that there was a book to the movie Conjuring. I'm like, come on, guys, where you been? Hiding under a rock? they're like, well, cool, that's awesome. We're going to tune in. So, can we talk a little bit about that while George is getting your coffee, and then we'll get into the, the potatoes and meat of all of the good stuff that you're going to be getting into, and you know, we'll go from there. So can you just briefly, you know, fill everybody in about the book, House of Darkness, House of Light, and, you know, your experiences of, you know, of living in that home, and how it's changed you today?
Well, I can do all of that, but I can't do it briefly. When you think about the trilogy is 1,500 pages, and it encompasses more than a decade. And not only does it chronicle the events that seven mere mortals, i.e. my family, experience,
right.
but it also details as much information and speculation as possible about the nature of the spirits in the house. So it's, you know, it's got a cast of characters of seemingly thousands, but as I've always said, the house has the lead role. The house has the lead. The house is a portal cleverly disguised as a farmhouse, and it is an absolutely amazing, amazing place that we spent a decade, the 70s, living in. We moved in. My mom found it in 1970. My parents bought it. We moved in. They bought it in December of 1970. My mom found it in June. It took that many months to negotiate the sale and get everything, the surveys done, and, you know, the whole nine yards. And then my mom, of course, didn't want to move her entire family at Christmas. So we waited until January 11th, 1971 is the day we moved into the farm. Coincidentally, that was George's 8th birthday. So the cosmic forces were already in play. He has visions of the farm, by the way, that this is an interesting aside you can ask him about. He has had projections and visions of the farm, not now, but when we actually lived there.
When he was younger.
Yes, while we were actually living at the farm, when he too was a child. And I mean, he called me up one night. I don't know, I guess it was midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and he's like, I just saw Cindy sitting out behind the barn. She's sitting on a large metal thing, and she's smoking a cigarette, and when she puts it out, she puts it down in a hole. I said, George, I have not thought about that in 40 years. Cindy would sneak a cigarette out of my mother's pack, and so she wouldn't get caught. She'd go sit out behind the barn on an old engine block that my father had discarded from an English Rover. And he had pulled the spark plugs out. So, of course, there were holes in the engine where they go. And when she finished the cigarette, she'd put it out and tuck the butt down in the empty hole so that nobody would see there were cigarette butts out behind the barn.
Right.
And I hadn't thought about that since the first time I caught her. And I was probably 16 at the time, and I don't think I've thought about that since. And he reminded me of that. Then one night he called me and he said, you were going down the stairs to the cellar, and you were nervous about going down there, and you weren't sure-footed, and you scraped your shoulder on a nail that was coming out of the horsehair plaster. Now, mind you, George has not read the books, nor has he ever been to the farm inside it. And
wow.
I looked at my mother, and then I had this awkward silence, and he said, yes. And I said, I still have the scar.
Wow.
You know, so there's some kind of, you know, who knows what it is. I don't think that either one of us will ever be able to explain his perceptions and how he can travel back to that time and see us living there and be able to describe every room of this farmhouse the way that he does in incredible detail, even though he's never stepped foot in it in this lifetime. There is no explaining that, but it does speak, I think, to a profound connection that he has to the story and to our family, even though there is no ancestral connection between us whatsoever. I think it speaks to a higher type of connection, if that makes
sure.
sense.
Sure, it makes perfect sense, right.
Yeah.
Some
yeah. So
spirit,
anyway,
you know.
Getting back to the farmhouse, We lived there for 10 years. An incredible amount of things happened while we were there. They are all chronicled, not all, pardon me. They are mostly chronicled in the trilogy. There were several incidents that occurred that my sisters, that I knew about or that my sisters shared, but asked me not to include because they were so personal and so so troubling even all these decades later that they didn't want to put it out into the world. But I would say that 98% or more of the significant events that occurred in the farmhouse are chronicled in the trilogy House of Darkness, House of Light. There are, you know, the Warrens only came and investigated our house, not by invitation, by the way. My mother didn't even know who they were when they showed up at the door. But actually, Keith Johnson had inexplicably shown up at the house a couple of months before with his team from Rhode Island College. And he's the one that informed the Warrens that he knew of a family that had a predicament. And so he brought them in on what originally he perceived to be his case. And the Warrens unceremoniously kicked the college students to the curb and took over by convincing my mother that, you know, they were authorities in the paranormal. There are no authorities in the paranormal. There's no such thing as a paranormal expert. We're all in this together. Believe me, if we don't know what was going on in that house, no one on the planet does. We lived with the spirits. We lived with the dead for 10 years. We got to know them. There was contact and interaction. So, and if we can't explain how it works, why it works, where it comes from, nobody can. But I will tell you this, you know, I know what it's not. It's not a figment of imagination. It's not, it's not separate from us, Kristen. And I know you know what you're saying.
I don't think
that there is such a thing as a veil. I think that that's a self-imposed barrier that we impose on ourselves to make us feel safe and live in a three-dimensional, five-sensory world. But we're actually living in a multi-dimensional reality that is multi-sensory. And I think that children are born knowing that, and that it's conditioned out of them by the adults that had it conditioned out of them. And it's a way for us to feel safe. But unfortunately, because of that, because we do not acknowledge the fact en masse that we are completely, utterly, totally surrounded by spirit at all times, that we instill a belief that there's something unusual or wrong or weird or dangerous about it, and therefore it instills fear in people. And the vast majority of spirits are not malignant, they're not malevolent, they're not maleficent, they're not. The vast majority of spirits are either completely, utterly benign, or they're benevolent. However, just like in society, you're going to have an element, you know, that unsavory element that were, you know, monsters when they were alive and continue to be monstrous once they're gone and linger and stay for some reason. And it's not up to us to usher them to the light. You know, that was one of the first things that my mother figured out once she understood that the house was haunted. And she always insisted with us that we be respectful because, as she put it, it was their house first.
Right.
We're the ones that are imposing ourselves on them as far as they perceive us. So it was a new and interesting perspective. You know, the Warrens were in over their heads from the moment that they stepped over the threshold. Mrs. Warren admitted that to me a few years ago, that this was something that they had never encountered before, which was why the movie The Conjuring was made, because They were contracted, Mrs. Warren was contracted with Warner Brothers Studios and New Line Cinema to make The Warren Files, a series of movies based on her most extreme hauntings, you know, that she and Ed
sure.
chronicled while he was still alive. During the 40 years plus that they were involved in the research and background in paranormal supernatural studies, they conducted about 10,000 investigations. And when they were asked what was the most important, the most disturbing, the most intense, the biggest one they ever did, they said the Perrin family haunting. And James Wan just sat there and shook his head, because he said, I'm sorry, but I'm an aficionado of the Warrens. I've read every book. I've seen every film. I know everything about these people, and I've not heard of this case. And now, how could that be? And it was because she, in writing about it and lecturing about it, after she had a confrontation with my mother in the early 70s about people showing up to our house, knowing our names and knowing where we live, and when asked about it, divulged that they learned about it from the Warrens during their seminars, my mother confronted Mrs. Warren and said, we had a confidentiality agreement, and
That's
you're
right.
the one that breached it. And
That's
you're
right.
talking about us. You're telling people how to find our house and how to find us, and that has to stop now. And it did. It did
Good.
Stop. But unfortunately, you know, the word had gotten around. We even had a man show up in a Chevy station wagon from Fresno, California, drove the entire contiguous United States to come find us and our house because of a seminar she had conducted out there with her husband. And
what was he seeking to find?
Yeah.
Well,
so,
what did he seek? I mean, why was he there? Why did he...
Because they spoke about the extreme haunting. They spoke about our family and our case after they had already been to the house a couple of times, and they went out to do a seminar in California, and this man showed up about 2 weeks later. He said he was so fascinated that he had to come see the house.
So he just wanted to see it, and he didn't want to investigate or interview or ask questions. He just wanted to simply sit outside and see it?
No, he wanted to meet the family and come in and make himself at home.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, yeah, you can't have that.
No, that's not
no.
cool.
No, so anyway, my mom had it out with her about that, and they stopped and they started, you know, changing our name. But they were talking at great length about some of the incidents that occurred in the house. However, they investigated between October 1973 and August of 74. They came to our house five times. We lived there another 7 years. So there were
wow.
many, many things that even the Warrens didn't know anything about that occurred, but all of it is chronicled in the book. And it really isn't, you know, I tell people all the time, if you're going to read the books, be ready to read the books. Know that you're prepared to read them. And please don't go in with the expectation that it's a series of scary stories, because it is so much more than that. If you rush through it trying to get to the quote-unquote scary parts, you'll miss the entire point of it.
Right.
It is a spiritual journey. It is meant to be a spiritual journey. Because we lived in the darkness, we saw the light. And enlightenment is not an easy process.
There are some
really significant and truly profound things that happened at that house that the Warrens were completely unaware of. And even though I gave all the information that I possibly could to the screenwriters, to New Line Cinema, to the executives, they had no choice, because it's impossible to compress 10 years into 2 hours.
Right.
They had no choice but to cherry pick that information. And because the film is not based on the books, but is instead based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren, Bathsheba Sherman copped the blame for everything, because Mrs.
Right.
Warren, to her credit, when she first came into the house, not knowing anything at all about the history of the house. She came in and she covered her eyes, touched the black stove in the kitchen, and said, "I sense a malignant presence in this house. Her name is Bathsheba." And there's no way that she could have known that. No way.
She just called that out. Yeah, that's a unique name.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other side of that coin is that from that point on, anything that happened in the house that was perceived to be negative, Bathsheba caught the blame for. And
sure.
She is not the one that was attacking my mother. She is not the one that was threatened by my mother. She is not the one that was threatening my mother. The spirit that was threatening my mother had a broken neck, clearly visibly a broken neck. Her head was hanging off of her neck and shoulders, her shoulders, and her head looked like a desiccated hornet's nest with a little slit for a mouth, jagged yellow teeth, two holes where her nose would have been, and hollow eye sockets. She was absolutely gruesome and horrible, and the only thing that I ever saw of her was in a vision that I had of her when I was in a state of paralysis, and as my mother was screaming for me to come help her, I wasn't able to move and intervene on her behalf. But I saw exactly what was coming down on top of my mother at 5:15 in the morning. And that happened within the first 9 months that we lived in the house.
Wow. You know, I remember sitting on my big chair and the movie came on. It was just on regular rotation. And I went to the bookshelf and got the book and, you know, man, Andrea, you know how we connected. You know that we have some similar situations that we've lived, and I cried so hard in empathy for what the family had gone through. It just hit home. And I remember texting you that day, and I was like, "I'm so sorry." And you're like, "What?" that's all I could say. I'm just so sorry that happened. You know, because it's heart wrenching. That is something, you know, how does one survive after that? Because, you know, you're very resilient. You're talking about it. You're being public with it. Have you helped any families since then?
Oh, my God. I can't tell you how many people have written to me and said I kept what happened to me a secret for most of my life. And it wasn't until I read the trilogy that I was completely liberated to tell my story, and now I tell everyone, because if you and your family had the courage to bring this out into the world, knowing the kind of blowback you'd get, then I have the courage to tell my story. And it seems to be, in an odd way, this trilogy of books, because I think it goes into such depth and such detail. You know, when something like this happens to you, you remember everything about it. And because it's from the perspective of seven people, you're getting, you know, you're not getting it double barrel. You're getting seven times the experience.
Right.
And it seems to unlock people's fears. And that is, to me, the greatest gift that I could leave in the world is any part that I could play in the dissolution of fear is a gift to humanity.
Absolutely.
It's wonderful to me to receive those letters and to be able to respond in kind and say, "Be the light you seek. I choose to live in the light." You know, it doesn't mean I'm cheerful and happy all the time. I can be absolutely miserable. But even when I'm miserable, I'm happy, you know, because I'm alive. And I had this experience and came out on the other side truly enlightened by it. And even though every time I say it in her presence, my sister Cindy slaps me, I say it anyway because to me it was the best decade of my life. I learned everything I needed to know about life and death and the afterlife in the 10 years that I grew up in that house. It set me off on a path in life, a path of inquiry, a path of discovery. It opened up my curiosity factor. It just increased exponentially, tenfold, 100-fold. because of living in that house. The spirits were never unkind to me. I never had an issue. I never had an altercation. They weren't after me. And I'll tell you, it's as though even when I was a child, I knew that I would be someday, we would tell this story and that I'd be the one to do it. You know, I was the writer in the family. I went through journals like, you know, most people go through boxes of tissues. I just write prolifically. And it to me, it's the greatest story ever told because it frees people to be open to the possibilities. When I first saw my first full body apparition, I wasn't afraid of him. I was relieved that there was something beyond death, that it wasn't just ashes to ashes and dust to dust, that everything that we accomplish, every memory we make, every love that we have and lose, every kiss, every hug, every tear, every joyful holler, everything in life is not just lost when our heart decides to stop beating, that there's some element of us that goes on. And I find that extremely hopeful and exciting. And it's not that I'm anxious to die. I'm really enjoying this thing called life. You know, but I'm not afraid to die. I live fearlessly because of my knowledge that I do go on. And that doesn't mean that I live recklessly, but I do live fearlessly because I know there's something beyond our mortal existence and there's nothing to fear.
Wow, that's very profound. Thank you for sharing that. You know, you said that you first saw your first apparition and you weren't scared. Can you describe what that apparition looked like? Can you share that with me?
As soon as we moved into the house, January 11th, 1971, in the middle of a swirling snow and ice storm, my father opened the back of the moving van and he handed me a big-ass box. I remember it was really heavy. I think it was cast iron, I swear. And take this to your mother in the kitchen. And I went into the nearest door, which was into the parlor of the farmhouse, and then took a hard right into the dining room. And Mr. Kenyon, who had sold us the property, was packing up the last of his belongings out of the china hutch that's inlaid in the dining room. And his table was still there. We hadn't moved our dining room table in yet. And he was packing the last of his belongings, his boxes. And when I walked into the room, there was a man who was very oddly dressed standing in the corner of the room near the door jamb that goes into a front foyer area that leads into the kitchen. So I had to walk right past him. He appeared absolutely solid to me, Kristen. There was no distinction made. It never occurred to me that I was looking at a spirit. I thought that the people in Burrillville just dressed funny, honest to God. And And as I walked past him, I said, "Good morning, sir." And he didn't look at me and he didn't respond to me. And I just kept walking. And when I went into the kitchen, I said, "Mom, who's that man with Mr. Kenyon?" And she said, "There's nobody with Mr. Kenyon. His son's not here yet. He's on his way." Well, okay. I went to go get another box. I went out the kitchen door. And then Christine walked into the kitchen and said to my mom, "Who's that man with Mr. Kenyon?" And she's like, "There's nobody with Mr. Kenyon. His son's on the way." And then Cindy walked in and said, "Mom, who's that man with Mr. Kenyon?" And Nancy came in right behind her and said, "The man with Mr. Kenyon just disappeared right in front of my eyes." And wow. And everybody just kind of looked at each other, and it was chaos, and there were boxes everywhere and people everywhere and kids everywhere. And my mother just shook her head and just kept going. And that was our introduction to the spirit world at the old Arnold Estate in Harrisville, Rhode Island. That was it. And then a couple of nights later, Cindy crawled into bed with me. I had the bedroom right over the parlor. There were three huge, enormous bedrooms upstairs. And I had the one over the parlor. Cindy and Chris were in the middle bedroom. Nancy and April were in the far bedroom over the kitchen. And Cindy crawled into bed with me, asked permission if she could sleep with me. Of course she could. And when I peeled back the covers, I asked her why. And she said, I hear voices in my room. The first thing I thought was Chris is talking in her sleep again. And I asked her, and she confirmed that it was not Christine, who has a proclivity for talking in her sleep, by the way. And I asked her what she was hearing, and she said, there are voices. They're coming. They're all around my bed. Even when I put the pillow over my head, I can still hear it. They get louder and louder. And I asked her what it was saying, and she said, they're all talking at once, and they're all saying the same thing. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. That's all they ever said, and they said it over and over again, to the point where she wanted to blow her brains out, and she couldn't get away from it, and so she came and slept with me, thinking that that was her great escape. There was no escape from the spirits in the house. It was their house first, and there were at least a dozen that we saw full apparitions of on a regular basis, but there were spirits in the house that sometimes we'd only see them once and then never see them again. So it's just an extremely active place. And, you know, my mother made sense of it years later by saying, you know, eight generations of one extended family lived and died in that house. And a good number of them decided not to leave.
They remained attached to the home.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And the land, yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are not random spirits passing through. They have an attachment to this property. And that's when she started trying to figure out the history of the house and enlisted the help of our neighbor, Mr. McEachern, who was the town historian. And he's the one who was at that time in his late 80s. And he's the one that told her about Bathsheba Sherman. And, you know, Bathsheba never actually lived at the farm, as far as we know. But she has an attachment to it as well, because he told us that when she was a young lady, a young woman, late teens, possibly early 20s, a child that was in her care there, either she was babysitting or we don't know the details, but was at the farm, and the child, the infant that was in her care, died. And when the body was examined, the doctor found that a needle had been impaled at the base of its skull some way or somehow, and the cause of death was convulsions. Because it was such a suspicious death, there was an inquest. Burrillville wasn't even incorporated yet. And so the town seat for that area of Rhode Island was Chepachet. And there was an inquest that took place sometime in the late 1830s or early 1840s. Involving Bathsheba when she was still a fair. She wasn't married to Judson Sherman yet. And the judge let her off the hook because she vehemently and adamantly proclaimed her innocence, that she had nothing to do with the death of this child, and that whatever happened had to have been a terrible accident because she would certainly never hurt the baby. Well, the judge dismissed it. Of course, it was well before the days of DNA analysis and forensic science and so on. There was no way to prove that she had done anything to hurt this infant. But in the court of public opinion, she was tried and convicted. And the rumors began spreading then that she was a witch that had sold her soul to the devil through the sacrifice of this infant to attain eternal youth and beauty. According to the historian, Mr. McEachern, she was an extraordinarily beautiful young woman. And because of all the wars and all the loss and all the disease, the women outnumbered the men mightily at the time.
Sure.
A good woman was hard to find, and in that time, women couldn't just make it on their own. So she was a threat to the women who were looking to snag a husband. And she was shunned in her own community. Well, that was not a time where you just picked up and started over again someplace else because the people where you lived didn't like you. She lived a long, miserable life in Harrisville, Rhode Island. Eventually, she got married to Judson Sherman, and she lived at the Sherman Farm over on Collinstaff Road, which, as the crow flies, is less than a mile away from what was our house. So she never really left the area. And according to the historian, she, you know, was not a particularly nice woman, and that she was very cruel and was extremely harsh in her treatment of the farmhands, that she would beat them, that she would starve them. She was particularly mean to men. And he would lower his eyes when he would speak about her to my mother. But, you know, keep in mind that it wasn't that long after women were being hanged and drowned and burned just
right
up the road in Salem. Throwing
that's
the
right
word around was a very, very dangerous thing to do. And in some ways, she's probably lucky to have escaped with her life. But I will tell you this, my family does not believe that Bathsheba Sherman was the one that was wreaking havoc in our house. And I'll tell you, there are a couple of reasons why. I already mentioned the fact that the spirit that was doing that to my mother had a broken neck. Bathsheba died from a stroke. She died from the paralysis of a stroke. And she died in 1885. She was born in 1812. The spirit that was after my mother spoke in language usage of English, British English, but, you know, they were all originally from Great Britain, England, predominantly.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But her language usage was archaic in the 1800s. When she approached my mother and threatened her, she said to her, "'Twas mistress once afore ye came, and mistress here will be anon. We'll drive ye out with fiery broom. We'll drive ye mad with death and gloom." Her language usage in what was an incantation or some kind of chant that she targeted my mother with, that usage was out of style, I guess, by the 1800s. So that's also indicative of it being someone from an earlier age. So, you know, we'll never know. We'll never, ever know in this lifetime exactly who they were. None of them walked up to us, extended a hand, and said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so from, you know, the 1800s. That's not the way that they communicated with us when they did, which was a rarity, but did happen. For the most part, they just ignored us like we were the ghosts.
Right, yeah, I understand that. And I completely agree, you know, even with your mom going all the way back and stating this is their home first and to respect the spirits, you know. Sometimes mm-hmm. when they do, you know, pin you down or make you paralyzed or the physical parts of things, that aren't mm-hmm. psychological and that aren't explainable. I feel like that makes people that have experienced those types of instances, that makes them scared and that makes them feel like there are harmful spirits. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
does that make sense?
And that's legitimate, Christian, because yes, in that rare instance, there are harmful spirits. My mother was physically attacked repeatedly in that house. There was a spirit that was after her that told her, "Get out." And when my mother refused to leave, then she decided to insidiously infiltrate her from within. And my mother was oppressed, but my mother was not possessed, as was represented in The Conjuring. And my mother would never, ever have done anything to hurt any of her children. And that's what I take umbrage with the movie, because they deliberately manipulated the story to make it look like my mother was perfectly willing to kill her own kids. She found that element of the film so ridiculous that she dismissed it out of hand. What she did take exception to was the fact that we were portrayed as the godless heathen parents as opposed to the devout Catholic ones. And nothing could have been further from the truth. We were all born and raised in the Catholic tradition. We were all baptized. Several of us were confirmed. And my father was going to be a priest before he met my mother. He was educated in Catholic school. He was an altar boy his entire youth. And he was headed for the priesthood after the service until he met my mom, and then all bets were off.
So,
you know, that's a big disparity because, and the reason that I to it and my mother does as well, is because it sends the wrong message. It
Absolutely.
Sends the wrong message. It's like if you're an atheist, you're more likely to be targeted. That's crap. That's not true at all.
It doesn't matter.
Legitimate researchers will tell you that often spirits gravitate to the most spiritual people.
That's right.
That they
mm-hmm.
show themselves to the people who are most open to and reflective of the Holy Spirit. So
mm-hmm.
it's entirely contrary to everything that even Mrs. Warren took exception to that. I watched the film with her 3 months prior to the opening. We were invited out to Hollywood for kind of a sneak preview, a private showing of the film. And even she said, that's not how it happened. That's not how it happened. You know, and this 87-year-old woman saying, no, the parents said, no, they were very devout people and they went to church. And, you know, she had an issue with that as well. You know, I think that Hollywood thinks that we're all stupid and that they have to dummy things down for us to grasp a concept. And I think quite the contrary is actually true. I think that most people are very sophisticated. And, yes, we did wait 30 years to tell our story. We did wait for the world to be ready and for, you know, that spiritual maturation process to happen. But mostly we waited because we weren't ready to tell our story yet. We had to get
right.
to a point where we didn't care what people were going to say to us about it anymore, that the story itself had more relevance than anybody's opinion of it.
It's hard. I honestly can speak firsthand. It's hard to put a story out, you know, something that is, I don't know, what society would not understand. They just, because if you don't experience it, you don't understand it, you know, that's just the bottom line to that. And it's very difficult to put yourself out there like that. I do have one question, though, that is I've always wanted to ask because of my own experience. With you, your family, your ma, and all of that, has the house ever tried to draw you back in since you've left?
Oh, Kristen, you just opened up Pandora's box, baby.
I know.
Oh, God. All right. Where to start here? Hold on, George is about to start Primetime Paranormal on his network, so I'm going to exit the office and give him some privacy to do that and chat with you out
sure.
here. So
oh,
if there's
great.
Any echo, because I'm in the kitchen now. Yes, I guess the only correct answer to that and the only honest answer to that is yes. I have never felt at home any other place on Earth. I've always felt like, you know, the accidental tourist, the one that was just, that I'm the spirit passing through this life, because the only place that ever felt like home to me was the farm. And
right.
I was devastated the day my mother called me out at college, my senior year of college, and said, we sold the farm to the abutting landowners. She might as well have stabbed me in the heart, metaphorically, you know. It broke my heart. And when, you know, and I'm crying, and she said, honey, listen to me. Just catch your breath and wipe your eyes and listen to me. I told your father, and I told him the truth. I will not survive another winter in this house. And that was it. The decision was made.
the house was sold. They put it on the market. No takers, no bites, no phone calls, no nothing. And my father, when my mother started getting really panicked, my father went to the abutting landowners over in Massachusetts and offered them the deal of the century on the place, and they bought it. My sister Nancy was so upset that she went to them. She was their babysitter, and she went to them, said, I know you're not ready to move in the house. I know you have plans to restore it to its original colonial, blah, blah, blah. I will stay on as your caretaker indefinitely, no charge. I'll stay at the house and mind the property for you. And they, you know, immediately are like, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
So it literally fractured our family. We never lived together under the same roof again. Nancy refused to move to Georgia with the rest of us. So in June of 1980, as we pulled away from the farm with our big, massive moving truck and horses and all of our pets, and we waved goodbye to Nancy on the front porch, and there in the window right behind her was the spirit of a woman standing, saying goodbye to us as well. The one that loved us well and tucked us in at night and smelled the flowers and fruit.
The one that protected all of you.
Yep.
And she was there to protect your sister. And that was comforting. Yeah.
It's a very emotionally complicated story. It changed all of our lives. It changed all of us in fundamental ways. None of us was ever the same when we experienced it as we experienced it. And yes, there were moments of trauma. In fact, that's one of the mantras of the story that is repeated throughout the trilogy, childhood trauma, the gift that keeps on giving. You know, but once you're touched by spirit, that is a door that is kicked wide open, and you can't ever shut it again. It's just as though it's just kicked off its hinges, and it's never the same. And you can pretend it doesn't exist. You can turn your back on that open door. But eventually something will reach through and tap you on the shoulder and let you know that it is very much present and accountable. And there is no denying it. And there's, you know, the best thing to do is to simply embrace it and accept it for what it is, because it is. And that to me is miraculous. That to me is stunning. That to me brings great inspiration and hope. And it speaks to a lot of different elements of our humanity. I know for a fact that, you know, this isn't a matter of belief with me, Kristen. You know that. You've looked in my eyes. You know that I know. And that's really different than believing. You know, we believe in Santa Claus. We believe in fairy tales. We believe in mythology. Some of us do. I know that spirit exists. And if there's one, there's a multitude. And the thing that is so inspiring to me is that it's a gift to look into the eyes of a spirit is glimpsing into our own realm, where we come from, where we go to, that there are multiple layers of dimensions that exist simultaneously, and that how we comport ourselves in this life matters. It matters. I sometimes wonder if spirits that remain behind have unresolved issues, if they died so quickly or traumatically that they don't know they're dead, if they simply come back to visit places that they particularly loved in life, or if they are literally trapped. And it might be a combination of all of those things. You know, there were several spirits in the house that committed suicide? Did they not cross because what they perceived as crossing into the light might be hellfire and damnation for claiming their own lives? You know, is that their moral and philosophical dilemma that keeps them tethered and earthbound? I don't know if we ever answer these questions in life or if it will all just remain a mystery. But to me, it's absolutely fascinating. And having experienced it from the age of 12, I welcome spirit in my life, and I don't have any sense of malevolence around me at all. I choose to live in the light. Nothing permeates that. Nothing invades it. Nothing even dares. Nothing evil even dares come near me. I think we just...
Yeah, it doesn't show any troubles at all here in the studio. No. I wonder what happened.
Is that a number up there, 8618?
The number is, you're trying to call in, yes, it's 646-787-8618. Mm-hmm. Just hear the hostess.
Very odd.
Very. Are you able to get through? Maybe there's a problem with blog. Hmm.
The chat room says they hear another person. Is the other person me? Can you hear me?
I think they can maybe hear you and I, but...
I don't know. Chat room people, if you could you maybe type in? Okay.
Hmm.
Odd.
Maybe see if we can get
check that out.
Huh.
Nothing.
Well, then.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Huh. I don't know. See if you can get Andrew back on the phone. I wonder what happened. Sorry for the technical difficulties. Just like everything.
I don't think they can hear us.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they can?
Yeah, we can hear both of you, but not Andrea.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have her call back in. Just give me a second.
Yeah, see if she can call back in, because it's not letting you call in.
No, it's not.
That's what I mean. I wonder if they're having trouble.
George is having trouble, too, with his...
He is?
Yeah. Just give me a second.
Yeah, and even...
But they can hear us, correct? What was that?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're listening, we're trying to get her on the phone. We're just going to do it this way, the old school way.
Yeah. Hey, it's
good. Hi.
Hi. You know what? I got to call you to finish this because I don't know what happened. We don't know what happened.
No, I don't either. And I don't know where we went from.
We were talking about how nothing can harm us. Nothing can, you know, as long as we have the light, you know, all of that. And then just something pulled the plug, you know, and not literally pulled the plug on our end, but something just, it went down. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
yeah,
Kieran,
I know.
Kieran, it's
well,
happening.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I ended this was, you know, saying that, you know, I really do. Because of my exposure and some would say my overexposure to spirit, not only am I hypersensitive to it, but I can feel any kind of negative energy around me, and I immediately dispel it. Get away.
That's right.
And then, you know, you're not welcome here. Sorry. No room at the inn. And that works for me.
Yeah.
It works for me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's just I wear my St. Mike all the time. I wear my St. Benedict around my wrist, and I'm always working in the light. And I don't, it's not allowed. It's not, after, you know, what I have been through, after what you have been through, it's just not, get away. It's not allowed. Go away.
Yes, exactly. You know, people ask me all the time what I'm afraid of, and, you know, my automatic response is nothing. Now, I'm not particularly fond of spiders, but I am not really afraid of anything. But I will tell you, I'll divulge this. In January, I went with George and a number of people from an event, a fabulous event that happened at the Seven Sister Inn in Ocala, Florida. Bob and Maria Schmidt are the innkeepers, the owners of this incredible bed and breakfast that's so supremely haunted. It is just like, wow. The feminine energy in that place is off the charts. And part of the event was doing an investigation at the old Florida ghost town called Kerr City. Not Curse, Kerr, K-E-R-R, Kerr City. And I experienced some things there that were dark and disorienting. I felt like I was in a vortex. I couldn't find my way. I felt like my feet weren't quite touching the ground.
I understand.
I didn't know what direction I was walking in. I was completely disoriented after having this experience with the other women on the team. And Maria was heading the team. There were, I guess, maybe about 7 or 8 of us in the house. And I was sitting on a chair. And I had had this experience as a youngster, so I recognized it after the fact. But I was sitting on a chair, and it felt like the chair collapsed underneath me, like it literally broke to pieces. And I leaned forward to get off of it quickly and went down on all fours and looked around, and Maria quickly turned the light on, and now there I am on my hands and knees on the floor looking back at this chair that I expect to be in pieces, mortified that I might have broken something on the property. And the chair was absolutely fine. No harm done. But I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And afterwards, George was a little clumped about that. He expected me to stay and you know, work all night with them. And I blew out of there. I just left.
Right.
And I've never done that before. I'm not one to, you know, abandon ship. Believe me when I tell you. but something about that place just disturbed me. And it was male energy, and it was absolutely malevolent as it gets. It was creepy beyond measure. And, you know, this is his training ground. I mean, he's investigated there 17, 18 times, and he's brought stuff home with him from there that he's had to clear after the fact. It's very active. And dark, there's a dark, disturbing force there. And I said to him afterwards when he challenged me about it, he's like, you know, Andy, people were disappointed. They wanted you to stay all night. And I said, George, I'm sorry, but, you know, I don't need to go out proving something exists that I already know exists, and I don't ever want to feel like that again.
Right.
I had to deal with that in my childhood. I don't want to have to deal with it as an adult. Sorry. You know, and I suppose I was a little belligerent about it, but sorry. You know, it's a, when it comes to encounters of that nature, I simply don't need them. There's no room in my world for them.
Right. How did he clear? How did he clear the residual that followed him?
Well, I don't know. He just got into Blog Talk and just started his show, so now you can't ask him that either.
Okay.
But I know that he did some spiritual work. George is a deeply spiritual human being. He's really well connected. And I'm sure that whatever he did was spiritual in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And he stepped out of the darkness and into the light and shunned and dispelled anything that might have tried to hitch a ride with him. But, you know, he's had some, he has dealt with night terrors, very threatening dreams after he's been there, and he just fights his way through it. He's a fighter. He's a scrapper, and he won't allow it in the same way that you and I can just simply say and mean it, get out and don't come back. When he's in the throes of night terror, he's literally fighting his way out. And the dreams that he shared with me, that he has shared with a number of people, he's very honest about the details, as gruesome as they are, the details of these night terrors. And I guess the best way for George to explain it is that it was a battle of wills. It was spiritual warfare.
That's right.
And he is a spiritual warrior, much like myself. I am passionate about what I do and how I do it. And I know now, through the telling of our story in the trilogy, that what my role is, you know, all the years of my life, and I know you have dealt this yourself. I remember talking with you about this, about feeling like a misfit.
That's right.
Like I didn't belong here. That, you know, looking around at the world like, you know, what is this? Why am I even here? You know, feeling absolutely out of place. And it wasn't until in my late 40s that I started telling this story that I understood what my role is, and that is of a liberator. I hold the key around my neck. It dangles over my heart, and I use it willingly, happily, for anyone who seeks release from fear.
The key also represents prosperity and opening doors, and I feel like you've opened so many doors for so many people that have felt lost, and they don't know where to turn, you know? So keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope so, because, you know, Kristen, I never married. I never had children. I have been a solitary figure, really, for my whole life. And, you know, it doesn't mean that I haven't loved and lost, as everyone has. You know, yes, I have, but for the most part, I have felt very insulated and very isolated, which probably... you know, probably why I haven't had what I've always wanted, which is a lifelong relationship, never manifested for me, because I did feel separate and distinct from the rest of the world. But now that I've told the story to the very best of my ability. You've read the books, honey. You know I opened a vein.
Yes.
I opened a vein.
A good
one. Everyone in my family did.
Mm-hmm.
Every member of my family did. And I left something in the world because of it. I left my triplets. in the world because of that. There are people that have not even been born yet that will read my books, and it will change their lives. It will open their minds to the possibilities. It will touch their hearts in inexplicable ways that they just can't even put into words. But it changes the way people think. It changes the way they look at the world, the way they look at the universe. You know that the books are a lot more than just a series of scary stories. They are rooted in the questions. How could this have happened? Why?
Yeah.
When?
Right.
Where? How did this happen to our family? And what good has come of it? Well, what good has come of it is the way that it helps others. And that's the icing. That's the cherry on top, the way that it touches other people's lives.
Kira Betazold, I think I'm saying that correctly. She's in the chat room, and she said, remind her she is never alone. So she wanted you to hear that. She wanted me to convey that to you.
Oh, I know. I know. And I've learned that. And sometimes, you know, there are actually times that I wouldn't mind having a little privacy.
Oh, absolutely. We're coming out of 2 years of that, you know. I think things are gonna start getting busy. But
Well, between the ETs that like to gravitate around me and the spirits that live with me all the time, it gets a little crowded. I know, and I appreciate that. I get to hold the hand of humanity now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I'm saying anything different than I've been saying for all the decades of my life. And it's not that I'm saying anything different than some of the greatest philosophers who have ever lived, some of the greatest theologians who have ever lived. I'm spreading a message of love and peace and joy. Well, you know what? Jesus did the same thing.
That's right.
And many, many others. But for some reason, coupled with this story, it seems to resonate with people. They can hear the same words said 1,000 different ways by 1,000 different people. And yet when I say it, it's like they're hearing it for the first time. And that's magic.
Okay.
And that's also very powerful. And so I am always, always mindful of that power and how I use it, because I am a very powerful woman. I know who I am now. I don't flounder anymore. I am a woman on a mission, and that is to change the world, to change world consciousness. And I might only have 500,000 people who even know I exist, but 3-4 years ago, you know, people who knew I existed were in the tens of dozens,
right,
not the tens of thousands or the hundreds of thousands. So my presence and my message, not even my presence, I don't care about my presence. This isn't ego anything. I don't care about that. What I care about is the message. And that's what gets through to people, that there is something to celebrate here, that being touched by spirit is not a curse. It's a blessing. It's a glimpse into where we come from, to the other side of our reality. You know, it's not that our reality has changed. Our reality has not changed at all. Our new reality is exactly the same as our old reality. What has changed is our awareness of it.
That's right. Our perception and our awareness. That's why we started Witch Talk Radio. Gosh, what are we on, our third season? First season was a little rough and rocky because we didn't know what we were doing, but we were going to do something, you know? but the second season was good, and this one's even better. But that's why we're here, is to educate. We're here to educate that there is something other than just us. That There is spirit. There is manifestation. There is will to live. You know, if you ask for things that you need instead of things that you want, you're more likely to get the things that you need, you know, and that's important for everyone to know. And I feel like there's so many people out there that are lost. And, you know, with this special topic tonight, you know, with hauntings and paranormals, Andrea, you know, there's at least 4 or 5 dozen of men and women and children suffering because they don't know what the hell to do tonight. They're scared to go to sleep tonight. They're scared to walk in the kitchen to get a glass of milk. You know, they just don't know. And I, you know, that's why we're here, because they don't have to be scared. They don't have to be. There's resources out there for them to receive help. It's going to be okay. You know?
There are resources. There are people that have experienced this that can help you through this. You know, it is a trial. It's a trial by fire. I know there are incidents that occurred in the house that I will never forget for the rest of my life. You know, the movie portrays my mother being possessed, and that Ed Warren stepped up and did an exorcism in our cellar. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Warrens foisted a seance upon my parents one night in August of 74. It was the night that my father punched Ed Warren in the face and threw them and their entourage out of our house. That wasn't represented in the film. It made it look like, you know, we were there for a matter of weeks, maybe months, certainly not years, and that they stepped in and solved all of our problems. And the absolute opposite occurred. And it wasn't their fault. I don't think that they were trying to exploit us. I really don't. I think that they were trying to legitimately help, but they were going about it the wrong way, and they brought a medium with them who did a conjuring at that table that night. I was peeking through a door. I wasn't supposed to be downstairs. I had Cindy, my sister, with me, and we were watching this occur. And what I saw that night changed me irrevocably. I had looked into the face of pure, unadulterated evil. I had seen what it is capable of. Whatever it was that attacked my mother that night, that picked up a 200 or 300 pound table and then slammed it back down onto the floor and literally imprinted the impressions of the bottom of the legs into the wood. That's how hard it hit the floor. Then my mother was lifted after whatever it was that the medium invited into that household that night went to the weakest link, and that was my mom. She was the one that was most vulnerable at the time, Kristen. And it took over for several minutes. And when it was done speaking through her, in a voice that was not her own, in a language that does not exist on this planet, when everyone in the room was petrified, when the priest had moved away from her and went to the far corner of the room, standing there trembling, when the medium collapsed on the table and my mother was picked up in that chair, and in a fraction of a second, around 20 feet from our dining room into the middle of the parlor, when I heard my mother's head hit the floor, I thought I saw her die. And that is as traumatic an event as has happened in my lifetime. I never want to repeat anything like it. And that was not represented in the film at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are elements of truth in the film. There are, but the vast majority of it was fictionalized. And I'll tell you why. When the powers that be at the movie studios got their hands on the real story, Volume 1 was already in the public domain. I gave them everything of significance in Volume 2. I told them how the story ended. I gave them 75 pages in treatment. I gave them a 3-page handwritten summary of major events, and they looked at all of it and said, this will run people out of the theater. We're going formula. And they toned it down and toned it down. and said no over and over and over again. Not only were they trying to get a PG-13 rating, which they didn't get anyway, because the MPAA said, it's just too scary. We're not giving you a PG-13. This isn't kid stuff. But James Wan had to be peeled off the ceiling. He was so angry. And he said, what do I have to take out of it for me to get the PG-13? And they're like, nothing. There's nothing that you can take out of this film that is going to change our minds. Nothing. And so it went out with an R, which, of course, doesn't mean that everybody on the planet hasn't seen it.
Right.
Since it came out on DVD. But, you know, it does misrepresent what actually happened. What actually happened is that the medium committed spiritual malpractice.
That's right.
Throw wide open the doors to the netherworld and invite everyone in without expecting some malfeasance.
That's right. You know, We practice protection, paranormal protection. I even give lectures on paranormal protection. And I am so against people using divination, especially in homes that are as active as yours or mine, or you know what I'm saying? And by the way, we don't live there. We haven't lived there in years, but we still own it. We can't get rid of that damn place. We just can't. We can't give it away. But
remind me to go back to your original question, honey. Obviously, I got off course here, and it just occurred to me that you would ask me if there was anything drawing us back to the house. And
oh, yeah.
Answer that for you when you finish talking.
I totally forgot about that, too. That's okay. Let's just jump right into that. Let's just go there.
Okay. Well, as I said, it's the only place that has ever felt like home to me.
Right.
And when I was with Lorraine Warren for the private screening of the film 3 months before it opened, I mentioned in passing, in her presence, that I wanted to buy the house back at some point. And that woman went into total meltdown. I mean to tell you, total meltdown. She started sobbing. She grabbed a hold of me. Now, this is in front of the director, the producers, but, you know, I mean, it's like, oh my God, what is happening here? And she said, no, don't you understand that house is calling you back? And if you go back, you won't survive this time. Don't you understand it will claim you? I mean, she was adamant to the point where I had to assure her that I wouldn't do it in order to calm her down. I don't want to live in the house again, but I do want it because of its significance to our community and to the world as a whole. This shouldn't just be privately owned property. This place is magical. It is, Kristen, and I want to open it to the whole world. I want it to be, you know, it's known all over the globe now. I want it to be open to all the very best investigative teams. I really, in my heart of hearts, believe that the one piece of indisputable evidence will come out of that house, the evidence that shuts the critics. The evidence that makes people look wide-eyed with wonder, that the only way to accomplish that is to wire that place with lights and, you know, microphones and have all the best equipment set up in every room so that when an apparition is moving from the dining room into the parlor, into the summer kitchen, up the stairs, that we're able to follow it depending on what cameras are set on it, what lights it's triggering, what motion sensors it's triggering, you know, and the only way to do that is to set it up as a permanent investigative site. And that's my intention.
Wow. So are you close? Are you close to reclaiming the home?
Well, the people who own it now, you know, I don't know if you've heard, and I don't want to dwell on the negative, but, you know, a 28-year-long friendship was fractured.
Sure.
With the Conjuring. I was good friends with, or at least I perceived myself to be good friends with the owners. And the woman who owns the house, she and her husband, you know, I never had an issue with him, never. Nor do I think that he had an issue with me. But she went ballistic when the movie opened and said some very, very negative things. You know, to a certain extent, I can understand her going to the national press and saying, go away, no ghosts here.
Right.
But she knew a whole entire story. She begged my mother for years to write a book with her, pertaining to not only my mother's experiences, but her own in the house. She invited countless teams of investigators in. There's a whole episode of Ghost Hunters, Season 2, Episode 7 about the house where they actually capture all kinds of evidence during, you know, John Zaffis was there. He's a good friend of mine, and he was there during that investigation. Grant was there. You know, my friends were there. I didn't even know she was doing that until it aired. She never even told me. You know, and my question, which I think is an obvious question, is why would you invite paranormal investigators to your home
if nothing was there?
If you don't think there's any spirits there, what are they there to investigate exactly?
Correct.
You know, so she did a complete 180, called my mother a liar, called me a liar, said that I made the whole story up. Yeah, right. Let me tell you how I met her. She walked in the front door of my restaurant in them is she's almost deaf, and the other one has sight impaired, and he is, yeah, I mean, he wears special glasses and stuff like that, and he does okay. He's not blind, but when both of them have visited that property, their senses have been fully and completely restored. And then when they leave, the impairment returns. And I just can't wrap my mind around that. I don't know what would cause that.
It's another dimension. It's like you said before, it's magical, quote unquote, you know what I mean? But still, it's that other dimension. It's that energy source. It's that power source. It's almost, to me, to dumb it down, the best way I can describe it, it's like the fountain of youth. You know what I'm saying? That's what I feel like it is. The constant source of energy that filters physiologically, psychologically, and it makes them at ease. It makes them at peace to where that they're able to hone in on those, the sight, the hearing, the audio, the visual. They're able to hone in on that because of the, I feel like they're at that relaxed state. I've witnessed things like that before. Do you know what I'm saying? Like I could, yeah, I could walk in. I haven't been well. Yeah, I think we're off air, by the way, so I think it's just me and you and Daniel. And if it's not, I'm going to walk in the other room so we can actually, you know, talk freely. Not have to worry about bullshit. But